Radio. Tonight, Eric Pruitt presents the Southern Slam Throwdown. Noir on the Radio host, Eric Pruitt, presents the Southern Slam Flash Fiction Throwdown. He's a screenwriter, a producer, a filmmaker out of Durham, North Carolina. He has a few short films out there that I'll get him to tell me about in just a second. His short fiction appears in the Avalon Literary Review, Pulp Modern, Thuglit, Zimbal, and to name a few. In 2015, he was the finalist for the Derringer Award for his short story Knockout. His novel Dirtbags and Hashtag are available in ebook and paperback. He's also the host of Crime Scene with Eric Pruitt and the Noir at the Bar series in Durham. I'm proud to present Eric Pruitt. Eric, welcome to Noir on the Radio. Hello. Eric, are you there?
Yes.
Let's see.
Yes,
Eric,
hello.
Hi. There you are. Eric Pruitt.
Yeah.
How are
hey
you?
There.
Hi.
Very
welcome.
Good. How are you doing, pal?
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
Hey, tell me about your short films.
I wrote one called Foodie that was directed by the great North Carolina director Christopher G. Moore. Went out and won a lot of prizes, and then ever since then I've been lucky enough to write a few more around town. Currently, I have one directed by Meredith Southey called Keepsake that's in festival submission, and then around the state, and we have about four others in pre-production or various stages of production right now. So it's fun. It gets me out of the house and off the computer.
How about that? How long is typically a short film, Eric?
I know that the successful ones tend to be about 8 minutes long, so you know, because they like them. The really good ones are short. So mine are mm-hmm. about 30.
Yeah.
About 20 to 30 minutes. they tell me the good ones.
A difference
you know, you
flash
can't hurry.
Fiction and a novella, right? You can't hurry masterpieces.
I say you can't hurry love, man.
There you go.
Can't hurry love. You just got to wait.
It's all yours. Take it away, Eric.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Yeah, we're really, really excited to take part in this. I've been a big fan of the Noir on the Radio series that the Authors on the Air Network's been doing, and I just jumped at the chance when offered that I'd like to do a Southern fiction section, because we've got some really, really good folks coming out of the South. And some of them, like a couple of our guests, you know, graduated from the hot summers and the icy winters of the South to go on elsewhere. And so it's going to be nice to talk to some of them to see the experience of, you know, being a Southerner and moving on, and as well to the folks that have stuck around and stayed. So, for example, tonight we've got Ed Brock, Greg Barth, Ed Kurtz, Jordan Harper, Sean S.A. Cosby, and Jamie Mason. And I'll introduce each of them one at a time as we get rolling. Let's just get started. Y'all want to? No,
all right, let's do it.
Yeah. No reason pussyfooting around, so let's go. We're going to start out. Number one, we've got Ed Brock tonight. Ed Brock's been a crime reporter and a journalist for more than 15 years with a two-year break to teach English in Japan. Pale and Death from 280 Steps is his first novel, and he lives in the Atlanta area. I'm going to go ahead and throw a little extra on there that on April the 3rd, Ed will be hosting a Noir at the Bar in Atlanta. I'll let you tell us a little bit more about that, Ed. Take it away.
Okay, well, I'll start with that then. That's going to be at McCrae's Tavern in Lawrenceville. It's my first time doing anything like that, so I'm scared shitless, but I'm sure it's going to be good because Mr. Pruitt's going to be there to help me out with it. And we got a good lineup. I don't have them all in front of me right now, but it's going to be good.
Yeah, just to throw it at you real quick, it's Alex Sizak, Peter Ferris, Grant Jerkins, myself, Eric Pruitt, Ed Brock, Ashley Irwin coming in all the way from L.A., Lauren Moore, and James R. Tuck.
Yeah, that's all them.
So it's
going
to be a good one. Yeah, it's going to be a good one. What are you reading for us tonight?
I am reading an excerpt from the book, Pale and Death. It's about midway through the book, so I better set it up a little bit with the basic plot of the book. Is about a fellow named Mark Freer, who is a reporter for a small paper south of Atlanta. And he finds out that the body of an ex-girlfriend has been dumped in his reporting area, and he is investigating it. And in this little piece, he's with a source, and they've gone to an event to meet another source to get some information about what's going on. So I'll just dig into it, eh?
Nice, nice. Take it away, bud.
All right. And the source's name is Red. Red found an empty space almost half a block from the house, parked, and got out without saying a word, and Freer followed. They crossed the yard toward the house, and as they drew close, Freer realized they had come to the devil's ball. The partygoers were bundled against the cold, mostly in black leather, fur, or brightly colored team jackets. Blue was the dominant color, and all the hats were tilted in the same direction. Many of them threw signs, casually, in easy greetings, fingers twisted into a secret alphabet. As they began to mix with others, some of them greeted Red in the same way, and he signed back. They eyed Freer with open suspicion, but let him pass. Freer tried hard not to hang on Red like a scared child and to keep his face from twitching as he nodded hello. He also noticed there were a lot of dogs. There were Rottweilers, Dobermans, and lots of pit bulls. Lots of pit bulls. Most were on chains, some were not, and Freer kept his fingers curled into fists and close to his side. They followed the driveway toward the rear of the house. Music blared from speakers on the back porch where people were dead. At the beginning of the wood line behind the house, Freer was hit by the strong smell of shit. He could see lights hanging from tree limbs to mark a trail into the woods, and he heard the strangest sound, barely rising above the music. It was a blend of human shouts and animal growls, sifting out from the deep inside the brush and pine trees. Red moved on down the trail. The path was fairly clear and obviously well-traveled. People passed back and forth along the trail, shadows eclipsing the bulbs that lit their way. Freer's ears throbbed from the cold and the pounding of his heart, and his foggy breath caught in his throat. The sounds of cheering and growling grew louder. As they ran around a curve and Freer saw a clearing ahead, brightly lit by portable spotlights like the ones you use on a construction site. There was a crowd at the far end of the clearing, silhouetted in the light so the individuals blended into a waving whole, a single throbbing organism in the night. As they crossed the clearing, Freer began to realize what he was seeing. Through the spaces in the crowd, he saw a low wooden wall that outlined a 20-by-40 rectangle around which everybody was standing. And he saw flashes of brown and black that rose above the wall and fell and rose again in another space. At the fringes of the crowd, Red stopped to watch the action. Freer got a good look at his first dog fight. The dogs, one black and the other brindle, were tired at that point, circling each other, ears torn, bloody gashes on almost every part of their bodies. They growled, teeth red, but neither seemed ready to restart the combat. Then something snapped and the black dove back in. Minutes later, the fight was over and the brindle was clearly finished. Four men entered the ring, two to retrieve the black and the other two to drag the brindle off the field. The rest of the crowd began placing bets on the next fight. Red was searching the faces around him, seemed to recognize one, and began moving toward a corner of the clearing where the two men had carried the brindle. Three other men were already standing there, two of them flanking the third like bodyguards. As Red walked up, he went directly to the third man, clasping his hand in a quick but complex shake. Gangs were a lot like Masons, Freer thought. The third man was shorter than his companions, but intensely muscular, dark with a slight mustache and close-cropped hair. He wore a Steelers team jacket. Freer figured him to be about 24. After some brief small talk with Red, the man looked at Freer and said, "This your boy?" Red nodded and turned to face Freer. Recognition flashed between them, bringing sudden panic with it to Freer. "Say now, Mr. Freer, how come you here?" said the other man, not necessarily threatening, but not yet terribly friendly. "Personal business, Mr. Pierce," Freer responded, trying to hold still. Tony Lamont Pierce, a.k.a. Dread, leader of a gang called the 52nd Street Boys, a name that always made Freer think of West Side Story. Of course, Dredd and the 52nd Street Boys had been involved in the death of a 5-year-old boy who had been caught in the crossfire of a shootout with some rivals, and that was a little heavy for a Broadway musical, particularly since the boy had been Dredd's son. His cover here, obviously, was blown. Luckily, after a few seconds of contemplation, Dredd's face softened. "You know, that was a real nice article you did on Little Peanut," he said, the endearment seeming to weigh down the corners of his mouth for just a second. "His mama and me, we really appreciated that." Freer nodded. "Glad you liked it," he said. "But, hey, everything we say tonight, that's off the record, cool?" Of course, Fear said. I'm not here for a story. Dread mumbled, nodding. They looked down to where the two men were standing, tending the brindle. Man, that dog is dead, he said. One of the men looked up at him, but there was no argument in his face, though the brindle continued to whimper. Then he simply turned back to his work. Dredd shrugged and looked back to Fear. So what you know about these people, he asked. That white girl was your friend, right? Fear nodded. Then it was his turn to shrug. Yeah, well, I hadn't seen her for years, he said. Oh, yeah? Phew, Dredd said. That means you won't take disrespect if I say that was one fucked up bitch. Fear stood and stared at Dredd, angry, but unable to find the words to defend Amelia or refute Dredd's description of her. You met her, he asked instead. Did it seem like she was in trouble? Dredd snorted again and looked back down to Brindle, shaking his head. Nah, man, she was trouble, he said. Bitch, would you shut the fuck up? He snapped his eyes back up to Fear and smiled. Again, no disrespect. Fear just nodded. What about the three guys? Dredd twitched to one side in dismissive gesture. Don't know the white boy, the fat nigga we call Big Boy. He was gone out of state for a long time, but he got back a couple of weeks with them other two. What's Big Boy's real name, he asked. Shit, if I know. Tony or Tommy or something like that. That skinny, well-dressed boy, he Big Boy's cousin, Ricky. Last I heard, Ricky was in somewhere up in Illinois, but I guess he got out. White boy just said his name was Bob. What are they doing here? Dredd fixed his eyes on Fear and shadows danced in his eyes. Well, now that is the question, ain't it? Fear hunched his shoulders. You tell me, what do they want with you? Fear said. Shit, man, there's what they're telling me they want and what they really want, what they're really after, yeah? They say they want to sell some stuff, mostly guns, but they don't show no product when we come to visit. So I start thinking maybe they're the type that like to rob a nigga. You know, people in my line of business, we victims of crime, violent crime, all the time. Not like the cops care. Fear nodded. Well, I'm trying to figure out all this shit out, so I'm afraid I can't help you much, he said. Dredd snorted, clearly annoyed that the information had flowed one way. I'll let you know whenever I learn anything, okay? Fear said. Yeah, call Red, he mumbled, his attention drifting back to the brindle. Goddamn dog just cost me $500. Another fight had begun in the pit, and the crowd was cheering and cursing. The man tending the brindle looked up at Dredd, and his eyes held surrender. You do it, he told Dredd. Dredd shrugged, and almost with the same motion, pulled a Beretta from his waistband and shot the brindle three times. The brindle only jumped at the first shot. The men at the pit jumped and looked their way, some of them reaching for their own weapons before realizing what had happened and going back to their bedding and shouting. Down at the brindle, saw steam rising from the body, then looked up and saw the moon, bright and full, floating through the tops of the waving pine trees. That's it.
Nice.
Nice. Good job.
See, that's what, yeah, that's what I like. The SPCA getting called on our radio show in the first, the end of the first reading. So good job, man. Way to go.
No animals.
No, that was great. That was great.
Writing up that story.
Hey, they were running, 280 was running a special on Pale and Death. Are they still running it, or has that ended?
It seems to be, I'll check the page real quick. I think it's still going on, but it was supposed to end pretty soon, so it may just be they just dropped the price permanently.
So I would jump on that, because I know they were also running a little special for you there, too, that if you review... If you give it a review on Amazon, that you're entered to win something coming up. So everybody that's out there listening, it's called Pale in Death. That's an excerpt that Ed just read. So jump on Amazon or go to your bookstore, however you get your drugs these days, and get it, and then review it, and then who knows, you might win some free shit. So great job, Ed. And
thank you,
Ed, remember, is. He's going to be in Atlanta April the 3rd for Noir at the Bar. So everybody, make sure to get your britches on and get down to Noir at the Bar. April the 3rd.
All are welcome.
Myself and Ed. All right, next up on the docket, keeping things rolling, is Greg Barsh. If y'all hadn't heard of Greg Barsh, then you can thank me now. I've delineated my life into the time before I've been exposed to the writing of Greg Barsh and the time after. So here you go, ladies. Greg Barsh is the author of Selena, Diesel Therapy, and the forthcoming Suicide Lounge. He writes crime fiction from Bowling Green, Kentucky. He's too modest to say it, man, but I think I heard his Selena series is was named like the hillbilly girl with the dragon tattoo, and I think that just about nailed it. So I picked it up not knowing really what. No, actually, I first heard you read it Noir at the Bar and blew me away. A white guy reading about you know, a woman having some, you know, crazy sex. You pulled it off really well. So I can't wait to hear what you do tonight. How you doing, Greg?
Hey, doing great, Eric. Great to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you.
Yeah, I've got a new novel coming out from All Due Respect Books on April the 1st, titled Suicide Lounge. And in it, there's this minor character in the ensemble who goes by the name Choke. And he's got a distinctive scar on his body. And I wrote something for tonight that shows how he got that scar. Totally independent of Suicide Lounge. It's not an excerpt. It's written exclusively for tonight's show. And only the listeners will know this little tidbit. Not a story exactly, but it's more like a scene, and there's no title. I just think of it as how Choke got that scar.
Extras on the DVD extras, right on. Take it away, man.
All right. So here it is. Choke didn't like the odds. When the two men stepped into the doorway of the storage room, Choke put down the case of George Dickel he was carrying and turned to face them. "We don't open for a couple more hours," he said. Both men were dressed in jeans and T-shirts. Neither carried a visible weapon. They were set for a shakedown, not a hit. "You hear that, Bob?" the shorter of the two said. "Fucking Indian here says he's closed." He took a couple of steps into the room. "Now that's real convenient, ain't it?" Bob said. He closed the door behind him as he stepped inside. "No interruptions. We can talk in private." Neither of the two would have been a challenge in a one-on-one fight. The one guy was short, spindly, with wiry little arms. He had moved fast, but he lacked strength. The other one, Bob, a large man, tall and muscular with long reach. Choke would have to take him down first. "We're here to have a word with Miles," Bob said. "He around?" Miles ran a local crew. His men were loyal and tough. Choke, a Yuma Indian with a history of violence, was his lead enforcer. Choke shook his head. "Away, on business, but I can speak on his behalf." "We was worried, you see," Bob said. "Thought something might have happened to him. My boss sent us to check it out." "Miles is fine," Choke said. "You shouldn't worry." "How come you ain't kicking up to the boss like they agreed then?" the little guy said. Choke flexed his fingers by his sides, making them into fists and then relaxing them. "We're not doing that anymore," Choke said. Bob cocked his head to the side, pursed his lips, and nodded. "You guys think you're strong enough that you don't got to kick up. Is that it? Like a little bird leaving the nest. The old agreement no longer works for us." "Miles said that?" Choke nodded. "I'm saying that on his behalf." "You can speak on Miles' behalf," the little guy said. "You can take an ass-kicking on his behalf. Kick your ass all the way back to the reservation, Cochise." The two men knew how to work together in a fight. Choke was about to get hurt. He didn't have any reason to doubt their experience. These guys were knuckle-draggers, tried and true. "My name is Choke, not Cochise. But both names are from the same root." "Whatever, Tano," Bob said. "Let's get it done, then," Choke said. "I've got work to do." The big man, Bob, stuck his hand in his pocket, pulled out a folding knife. When he opened the blade, there was a snap as the lock clicked in place. "Just occurred to me, since you're not Miles, you can do a lot more than kick some ass." The little guy brought out a knife of his own and took a couple of steps away from his partner. "We're going to skin you, man." Choke pivoted to his left, threw a kick at Bob's groin. The toe of his boot connected hard, crushing the guy's testicles. Bob grunted, slashed downward at Choke's shin with the knife, cutting through his jeans, slitting the skin down to the bone. Choke dropped his foot and let the movement carry him forward. He brought his right fist up and punched the man hard in the throat. Bob lunged forward and Choke put him to the ground with a haymaker to his left temple. Bob's ass hit the dusty cement floor. His upper body pushed over a stack of whiskey cases. The boxes fell around him, glass bottles smashing on the floor. Smell of whiskey tinged the air. Choke sensed the smaller man moving behind him. Knowing that his kidneys were exposed, Choke dropped to one knee. He took the point of the knife in his left shoulder. The blade sank deep, not stopping until it gouged at his shoulder blade. Choke grabbed Bob's hunting knife and wrenched it free from the man's weakened grip. He pivoted on his knee. As he did so, the little man's blade raked across his back, the point of it grating against Choke's shoulder blade, nicking his vertebra, then slicing deep across his right shoulder. Far from a lethal wound, but painful nonetheless. Choke continued to pivot, pushed his foot against the floor, and rose to his feet. As he spun around, he brought his knife up and sank the blade deep between the man's ribs. The little guy stabbed at Choke furiously. Choke brought his left arm around to block, taking the stabs in his forearm and bicep. Choke got up close, put his left arm under the guy's knife hand and around his back. He hugged the shorter man, pulling him in close. The guy continued to stab at Choke's back, but the wounds inflicted were superficial at best. Choke withdrew his knife from the man's side, brought the blade around, and shoved it deep in the guy's neck. He pushed forward and sawed with a sharp cutting edge, slicing the wound deeper and across the neck until a gush of hot blood flowed across the back of Choke's hand. Man's struggle slowed. The stabs weakened. Choke continued to push the blade, slicing until it was behind the man's ear, the tip of the blade embedded in his brain. Choke jiggled the blade from side to side a bit just to make sure. The smell of urine filled the room. Choke withdrew the knife, allowed the man to collapse to the floor. The long cut across Choke's shoulder blades began to sting. His shirt clung to his back. He felt the hot blood running down into his belt line. He examined the wounds on his left arm. He had a couple dozen stabs, cuts, and scratches along his forearm. He slipped the knife into his jeans pocket. He withdrew a bottle of whiskey from an open carton and poured the contents over his arm. Bob stirred behind him. Choke turned to him. "I left my gun in the bar," Choke said. "That was stupid of me." Bob gasped for air. He rubbed at the side of his face. Choke set the whiskey bottle aside and took out the knife. He leaned forward and buried the blade deep in the man's sternum. He sliced upward with the blade until the edge was against the man's breastbone. His diaphragm severed, Bob can no longer draw breath. As the light faded from the man's eyes, Choke said, "I won't be stupid again." Choke stood, looking around the room. What a mess. He'd have to get the bodies out to the incinerator before he could see to his wounds. Smashed liquor bottles and the rest of the mess could wait until later. Choke didn't mind the fact that Miles wouldn't do his own fighting. After all, it was work like this that kept Choke flush. But he had no illusion about Miles and his propensity to put others in harm's way. He paid well. He didn't care about those that fought for him. Choke wondered how Miles would react if the day ever came that one of his fighters turned on him. "That would be an ugly day," Choke muttered. And that's it.
Good job, Greg.
Nice. Sure. So this does not go in any book. This is straight up just a slice of something out, you know, in the Selena universe, but only right there, just a scene.
Only for tonight, yeah. This is the character Choke plays a small part in Suicide Lounge. You'll see him in that book.
Do you want to give everybody just a hint, you know, just like the main story that's running with Selena? From, I know that you've got three books coming, only two out at the moment, but do you want to give everybody a taste of what Selena's all about?
Story? Yeah, sure, I'd love to. So Selena is the nicest woman, living life on her terms. She has a tendency to overindulge a bit, and she might not have the moral compass that points straight north. She gets into a little bit of trouble here and there, and she's, you know, kind of teetering on the edge, but she's loving life where she's at. And living that sloppy, careless life, she makes a mistake that costs her a lot. She draws the crosshairs of a violent crime crew in a small city in northeast Tennessee, and they hurt her in a bad way. And she has an extensive recovery.
Yeah.
And then Selena's story is about how she makes things right with herself, because she can't live with the fact that these people just did this thing to her and got away with it. And then the story is really about what happens to those guys when Selena comes back after them.
Guys, it's a page turner too. I tore through that book. And then Diesel Therapy as well. So I can't wait for Suicide Lounge. So great job,
people first.
Greg.
Thanks.
And looking forward to seeing you for Noir at the Bar in Durham. Which we're kind of planning for June 16th. We'll have that official very soon. Speaking of anticipated reads, Sean, what's it, S.A. Cosby, is a writer from southeastern Virginia. He had been published in several anthologies and was published in Thuglit twice. Two great stories. Go look those up, y'all. His fantasy novel, Brotherhood of the Blade, was published in 2014 by HCS Publications. He recently completed his first crime novel, My Darkest Prayer. I can't wait. He resides in, is it Gloucester, Virginia, with his pug Pugsley. Gloucester, Virginia, mm-hmm. with his pug Pugsley and a cantankerous squirrel named Solomon. Sean, how are you doing?
I'm good, Eric. Good to hear from you. Good to hear from Greg as well. So, how are you guys doing tonight?
doing great, brother. Always.
Good
you are one
voice,
of my
Sean.
Favorite people. You're one of my favorite people to talk to, and, you know, I know that, you know, we hung out one afternoon before one of our short film screenings in Durham, and I think you and me just talked each other's heads off all day. You're one of the easiest dudes to talk to. So I'm looking forward to getting you on the radio.
You're the only –
what's that?
I hope – I said you're the one white guy that I've met that I don't have to explain drug lingo to, so it's cool that we can talk sometimes.
No, he'd be like, yeah, we're having a field party. Oh, by the way, that's a party out in the field. Yeah, I know what a field party is. we both grew up in the country, so we were speaking the same language all day long, and everybody was looking at us like we were foreigners, so it was great. hey, what are you reading tonight?
Well, much like Greg, I'm reading an original piece just for the hour. I actually, like I said, I wanted to read something from My Darkest Prayer, but I couldn't find anything that would clock in at the required time limit, and that's still in the editing process, so maybe it's best that we wait on that, let that marinate a little bit. So I'm reading a real quick little short story about some drug dealers that come looking for a guy for a debt, and it's called Slit the Belly.
Nice. Well, take it away, man.
All right, here we go. All right. Tron banged on the old screen door so hard the whole house seemed to shake. Day-Day heard shuffling footsteps approach the door, and he reflexively touched the butt of his Glock that was stuck in the waistband of his pants and rubbing against the small of his back. A robin whistled from a nearby magnolia tree, and somewhere what sounded like a pretty good-sized dog was barking in the distance. An old man opened the door. His skin was as black as midnight in a mine shaft. "Can I help you, boys?" he said. "We're looking for Truckee," Tron said. His voice was deep, and it always reminded Day-Day of Darth Vader. "Well, he's not here right now. He went to the store, but he should be back presently. You fellas want to come in and wait for him?" the old man asked. "Yeah, we can do that," Tron said. The old man smiled and walked into the house and then walked into the kitchen. Tron and Day-Day followed him. The old man sat down at a circular metal table. Day-Day and Tron sat across from him. A steaming cup of coffee was between them. "I'm Alvin Lee. I'm Truckee's grandfather. What they call you boys?" Alvin asked as he held out his hand. "I'm Tyrone and this is Dwayne," Tron said. And legally, he was right. That was their given names. No one in the street would flinch if they heard those names. But you tell them that Sean and Day-Day were coming, and homeboys would start running to church and praying for a miracle. Truckee got so many friends, it's hard to keep track. They coming by all times of the day and night. He always had a lot of friends. I think that was his way of dealing with his parents dying. I raised him, you know, raised him after the accident. Then his grandmother passed not long after that. Yeah, I lost my daughter, my son-in-law, and my wife in the same year, Alvin said. God damn, Day-Day said. He had killed four people in his whole life as an enforcer for the Shea St. Clair crew, but he had never wiped out a whole family. Yeah, that's what I said, Alvin said. Tron was looking over the old man's shoulder at the rooster clock on the wall. How long has Truckee been gone? Tron said. Alvin answered his question with a question. How do you boys know Truckee? Tron smirked. It looked like a snarl to Day-Day. We just know him, he said. Alvin smiled. Oh, I know how that is. I ain't so old I don't remember what it's like to have running partners. And believe it or not, I used to run with some rough boys myself, as you kids would say back in the day. Some real Nicky Barnes, Frank Lucas type of brothers, Alvin said. For real? Day-Day said. Tron shot him a look, but Alvin nodded his head slowly. Yes, sir. And before me, my daddy was a rum runner for a fellow out of Franklin County. Carried moonshine up the Potomac to some boys and took it north to sell the juke joints. Trucky though, he ain't about that kind of life. He was nice, you know. He won't cut out to slit nobody's belly, Alvin said. Huh? Day-Day said. Alvin laughed. He laughed long and hard. The skin on Day-Day's neck pimpled with goose flesh. My daddy told me if things got out of hand on the boat or if one of them northerners tried to short you your money, well, sometimes you had to make them disappear. So you dump them overboard, but you make sure you slit their belly first and poke holes in their lungs so the gases don't build up and they don't float to the surface, Alvin said plainly. That's messed up, man, Day-Day said. Alvin laughed again, but it was softer this time. Yeah, I guess it is, but, you know, you do messed up things and messed up things happen to you, he said. What'd he go to the store for? Tron said. Alvin stared at him. His hard brown eyes studied Tron as Tron studied his smooth black face and close-cut salt and pepper hair. He said he had to get some things, Alvin said. Like what? Tron asked. I don't really know. Some things, Alvin said. What store do you go to? Because we passed a 7-Eleven on the way here, and it ain't 5 minutes from this house, Tron said. Day-Day sighed. It was about to go down. It's a shame. He was actually enjoying the old man and his stories. Trucky ain't at that store, is he, old man? Tron said. Alvin didn't respond. He sipped his coffee, and then he put his hands flat on the table. And you ain't Trucky's friends. He got you more heart for the game you boys is playing, Alvin said. No one said anything for a few moments. Day-Day could hear the clock on the wall ticking in the silence. Suddenly, Day-Day reached for his Glock, and Alvin moved his hands under the table. Day-Day felt something hot punch him in the guts. He felt himself slide off the chair and into the floor. He saw a muzzle flash light up the underside of the table, and Tron was thrown backwards. Alvin stood. He was holding a sawed-off shotgun. A thin ribbon of smoke unfurled from the shortened barrel. He walked around the table and aimed it at Day-Day's head. Me? I ain't got no heart. Not after I did 12 years in Mecklenburg. My heart's gone. And so is my grandson. He's gone, too. He was so scared of you boys, he hung himself this morning. I found him in the shed out back. Alvin pumped the action on the shotgun and expelled a smoking shell. Lucky for me, there's old outhouse back there in the woods. I ain't gonna have to slit you boys open, he said as he pulled the trigger. And that's it.
Yes.
Wow.
This is right.
I tell you what, I'm sitting back here listening. This is Pam, your PA tonight. I'm sitting back here listening, yes, freaking out about this piece of flash. I was incredible.
Yes.
Oh my God.
He speaks a language that is foreign to people outside of the South. Like, it's just, it's dripping with country. Brothers, this is, write his name down. It's S.A. Cosby. He's in Thuglet. You got two stories in Thuglet. You got that. His book's coming out. Get ready.
Oh. That was
thank you
awesome.
Guys so much. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
I need to just take a second here before we go on. First of all, I need to get a cocktail after that one. Jay, see, that was good. I still got goosebumps. I want to remind everyone this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. You are listening to Noir on the Radio, the Southern Slam Throwdown with host Eric Pruitt. If you want to call in after our – we have still more authors coming up with some more great flash fiction. And I'm holding my breath. I swear to God, my heart is still pounding thinking about it. We want you to join the conversation and call in and chat with all of our flash fiction masters and mistresses here. The number to call is 347-633-9609. And when Eric has the last Reader, come on up. You're welcome to call in. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks, Eric. Take it away. And thanks again, Sean. That was just amazing. I'm going back to listen again. Wow, jeez, my goosebumps.
That's a really great compliment. I appreciate that so much.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you, Pam. Hey, let's roll real quick so we can make sure we can get some callers. We're going to go to Jamie Mason, which I'm really excited to talk to. Jamie, at first, my wife actually bought your book, and she had it back in her room, and I came across it when we were feeding our dogs. Every day I'd sit and feed my dog and read like two chapters, and then I just could, pretty soon it was me and the dog off in the room. I'm not coming out, you know, because it was such a great book. So, and I'm talking about three grade school. So you've since got money. Well, let me just read it here. Jamie Mason's crime fiction focuses more on the why instead of the who or how of murder and intrigue. She is the author of Three Graves Full and Monday's Lie. Jamie grew up in Washington, D.C. area, but now writes her suspense novels from the mountains of the great state of Western North Carolina. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing great. Thanks. How are you?
Very good. Thank you for coming on. What are you reading for us today?
It's kind of fun. This is a piece when you sent me this invitation, I remembered something. I have a critique partner actually in the UK, and occasionally he will, if I get stuck on something, he will toss out a prompt. And he said to me, I want you to write a little piece about a bad man who rolls into a desert town with an agenda. And so, yes. So this is what I wrote. This is adapted from that. And I probably should say at the outset that this story is from the point of view of a man. And that was all fine and well on the page, but I think out loud, I am not going to be fooling anybody. It would kind of turn into stand-up. It would kind of turn into stand-up if I tried to sound like this narrator. So I'm going to spare everybody the giggles, and we'll just agree that this is as manly as I get. But we'll just suspend disbelief because that's what we do, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so this piece is called Mojave Endgame. Betrayal is a way of life in the desert. It starts with the sun, the engine that drives the life cycle. In the desert, the sun gives out what it's supposed to, light and warmth. And it gives, and it gives, and it shoves those precious necessities down your throat until you choke on it, gasping for mercy. The clemency you think you want comes in the soft velvet of night to hide you from that pitiless brass bullet in the sky. Deep blue, shot through with pinpoints of crystal, seeps up from the east and shreds the burned-out canopy of the sky and chases it westward. And you, like an idiot, sigh in gratitude for about 10 minutes. Night in the desert rescues you from the blistering day, only to suck the measly 98.6 degrees that are rightfully yours straight from the marrow of your bones. And the fathomless beauty of the night sky purges all doubt that there is a God, and then it crushes your soul with confirmation of his magnificent remoteness. Even the rain is a faithless bitch, drowning in flash floods what should be bathing in the gentle cosmic tears of remorse for the harshness of the way things are. The lightning you can trust, it never pretended to be anything you needed. And speaking of faithless bitches, Daniela felt me watching her before I let her catch me at it. She always carried her unease in her shoulders. It was her one giveaway, and when she thought she was being watched, she made too much of an effort to roll them back and straighten that pretty, devious little head atop them so that anyone who didn't know better, and I knew better than anyone, would say to themselves, that girl's got the world on a string. And she did, only the other end of it was a neatly fashioned hangman's noose and the knot was slipping home. I found her easily enough and had to shake my head along with what was left of my ruined face at her predictability. The first sign of trouble is she runs back to her tedious life of peddling poorly constructed tract housing to the young and gullible. She'd been a low-rent realtor for her cousin before he recruited her into the police academy and before the suits recruited her into internal affairs as a mole. So foolish and typical on all of their parts. She felt the prod of my stare and turned her head to the source of the nudge. I leaned against the dusty door of my ill-treated and ill-gotten car for the span of three heartbeats. Well, three of my heartbeats, anyway. I imagine Daniela used up a good galloping 20 of her own once she saw that it was me. I ducked behind the wheel and slammed the door. She ran. Unfortunately for her, I'd been in the sad excuse of the town for 4 days already, sleeping nights in the car out in the barrens to avoid prying eyes. And I was confident I knew where she'd go. I got there just after she'd thrown the bolt on the trailer, as if that would have stopped me for more than a handful of seconds. The door and its pissant little lock were smarter than Daniela by a mile. They gave way without much of a fuss, and only one boot print to show for it. "Hiya, Danny." I snagged the back of her blouse as she ran and yanked her back, launching the middle buttons in three directions as the fabric stretched tight over her breasts and belly. "Way no," she shrieked as I spun her around and pinned her against the bare wall. I'd been in the trailer the day before yesterday. She had nothing. Just a suitcase full of cheap clothing, a few towels, and a change of sheets. The cupboards held a few paper plates, some plastic cups, and a handful of fast food packets of flimsy cutlery. The life of a disgraced, snitching ex-cop didn't look an awful lot different than an extended stakeout, and the irony of her grungy life had brought a smile to my lips. But it had also put a gun in my hand, so I jammed it up under her delicate little jawbone, making her wince. "You didn't hide very well, Danny." "Wayne, listen to me." Her voice shook, but to her credit, she didn't flinch her gaze away from the flaming knot of poorly healing scars that had recently been the left side of my not-so-bad-looking face. The side she'd always tilted into when she kissed me. Funny how when it's right between two people, they just know which side of the kiss is theirs. Tears diluted the denim blue of her eyes. "You know what they're going to do to you. I gave you over to Terrell because all he wanted to do was shoot you in the head. Well, good news, bad news, he's a lousy shot. I saw your file. You built my file, you bitch. You were going away forever, Wayne. There was no way out. You know what they do to cops in prison. There were too many people who wanted to take you apart. So you did it all for me." I pressed the pistol harder into her jaw, felt it grate against the bone. "I did love you." She finally cried out against the pain. "You don't know how it was for me. It killed me to do it." "No, it didn't, Danny. It didn't kill you. Let me show you the difference." But even as I said it, the quivering sincerity in her voice pulled my mind back to that same tone, but different, happier words murmuring in my ear in the dark, and Danny's muscular little legs wrapped around the small of my back. My concentration faltered, and that was it. 1 second's hesitation, and Danny brought the spike of her sensible short-heeled pump down into the top of my foot. It didn't connect as cleanly as she would have liked, but my involuntary cringe put just enough distance between us to allow that same muscular little leg to deliver a stout knee right into my balls. "Endgame, guys, endgame," Danny called out to the walls. The gutless door banged open again for the rest of her armed team just as easily as it had done for me. I'd only been looking for Daniela, not microphones. The place looked like a surveillance station because it was, in fact, a surveillance station. Daniela was not in disgrace. She was still a cop. Somehow she'd covered her own dirty tracks, all the things she'd done that made her not so different from me, except in the only point that mattered, she hadn't been caught. And now they were clapping her on the back with variations on, "Good job," and "Way to make the sale." She had known me. Known I would come for her once she heard that I'd survived Terrell. They were leading her out for debriefing and paperwork as two uniformed babies hauled me handcuffed to my feet. Daniela put up a halting hand to her escorts and made her way back through the trailer. She scrunched her gaping blouse closed in a white-knuckled fist, hiding from me what I'd thought of as mine. I'd mapped the skin there with kisses and caresses so far outside my usual handling of people. The ache in my balls prevented me from straightening up, so my wrecked face was even with hers. Her cool hand tingled over the warped skin and muscle that should have been a hole blown out of the middle of my skull instead of a cheap disfigurement. A quick execution at the hands of a gangster would have been my ticket out of the hell that awaits me at the last stroke of the judge's gavel. That's the ticket she had tried to buy me with a double cross that was as nearly as dangerous for her as it was intended to have been for me. Those tears were real. She had tried to save me. in her own way, in my own way, the way I taught her. She leaned in and our heads tilted effortlessly into place one last time. The night before had been so cold that I'd nearly abandoned my Jones for getting even. Heat, like what's offered here during the day, makes you mean. It feeds your angry plans. But at night, the cold will bleed the fever of hate right out of you. It'll trick an icy forgiveness into rattling around in your empty heart. And that foolish feeling will promise you anything to calm your brain into moving your body somewhere else, somewhere warm. I wish I'd caved. I wouldn't see Danny again outside a courtroom. We both knew it. From the back seat of the patrol car, I could still see the tears shimmering on her lashes through the glassy ribbons of heat floating above the road, this road I should never have come down. As far as I knew, it was the only time tears had ever fallen for me, not because of me, from anyone. Rain in the desert slides uselessly over cracked earth, but tears can soften a parched plot, maybe even enough to grow redemption. But like the light and the warmth, sweet and needed as they are, here in the desert, they burn. That's it.
Dang. Yeah. Good. Great job, Jamie. Where do
Thank
we get?
You,
can we talk to you? Can we talk to the guy in the UK that helped you? That gave you the prompt to come up with that idea for the story. Can he do that for all of us?
He's fantastic. His name is Graham Cameron. If you like dark, he has a wonderful book out called Normal. It's from a first person and a serial killer, and it is fantastic. Graham Cameron, he's terrific.
Well, nice. Hopefully if he gave us a prompt, we can do half as good as what you just did. That's amazing.
Well, thank you. It was fun.
And do you find that a Southern identity that you have? I mean, I know you're saying D.C., but technically that's the South. That's the definition of the South.
I keep sliding down the East Coast. We were in Richmond for a while, and now we're in North Carolina. And so I definitely feel it. And it turns out I've become an air snob. I don't like dry air. I only like green Southern air. So.
I tell you what, man, I've spent the last week in Dallas, and I haven't known how to handle it, you know. The dry air and the central time zone is affecting my hair in a bad way. But do you find that the Southern identity, it affects your writing? Do you get it in there?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think other people might see it more than me because I don't know anything else. So I don't know. I've heard that there is, but I'm not quite sure what that means. So it's not if it's there, it's not a purposeful thing. But I always can tell that I love being grouped that way because I have a tendency to very much like the company I keep when I'm grouped that way.
Nice. Well, thank you very much, and we're looking forward to trying to nail you down for the Noir at the Bar we're trying to put together for Durham, June 16th. We're working it out. We should know something within the, in a week or so. But yeah, that would be great. It would be great if we got you.
Yeah, I would absolutely love it. I would certainly make the drive out.
Sweet. All right. Thank you, and let's roll to number five. Ed Kurtz is the author of Nausea, Angel of the Abyss, The 42, and A Wind in Oz, as well as numerous short stories. His work has appeared in Needle, a magazine of noir. Needle, a magazine of noir. Beat to a Pulp, Shotgun Honey, Thug Lit, and several anthologies, including the Best American Mystery Stories 2014. Ed resides in Minnesota. Ladies and gentlemen, get yourselves ready for the voice. This is going to make you moist. Here comes Ed Kurtz. Ed, how you doing?
I'm well. How are you doing, brother?
There it is. It's so good to hear from you. Now, you recently immigrated. You're from Arkansas. You lived in Texas, but now you've given it all up for the frozen wilds of Minnesota. How's the transition going for you?
The land of ice and snow. I've survived the winter, I think. It's pretty warm for up here now. It's pretty nice.
You've been, without knowing it, you've been my spirit animal, because every time it starts to get really, really cold, I'm like, well, at least it ain't as cold as where Ed Kurtz is. So good. You've helped me get through my North Carolina winter. What are you reading for us today, bud?
The little thing I wrote a couple of years ago called Bad Luck Billy that appeared on Shotgun Honey.
I'm excited, sir. Do you need any setup, or you want to just take it away?
I can just take it away. You ready for me? All right.
Oh, man, I've been ready for a couple of weeks.
All right. Pushing a loose strand of auburn hair away from her wet eyes, she sits behind the wheel and stares across the parking lot and over the freeway, choked with traffic. One direction stretches north to Waco, the other southwest to San Antonio. But she goes neither way. She just sits, the motor idling, a cigarette burning between the fingers of her left hand, which hangs out of the open window. Al Dexter warbles on the FM station. The air conditioner doesn't work, but she lets it run anyway, hissing warm air at her sweat-slicked neck. Behind her, in the middle distance, Billy's garage sits like a gray wad of dust at the opposite end of the lot. The open sign still burns blood red, but the door is locked and all the lights are off. She'd forgotten to switch off the sign, something she realizes now as she peers at it by way of the rearview mirror. For a moment, she contemplates going back to take care of it, walks through the steps in her mind. She would have to get Billy's keys, walk back over to open the office door, but Billy's keys are in Billy's pocket. Billy is in the trunk, because that's where she stuffed him after she opened his throat with the bastard's own straight razor. How he gurgled, how his eyes begged for help. She decides to leave the goddamn sign on. Jerking the gear shift into reverse, she slowly backs out of the slot, curves around to the left, and shoves it down two notches to drive, pointed north. Al Dexter fades into Waylon Jennings. She hums along, unaware that she's doing so, and steps on the gas. Her plan, the one she'd hatched over her morning coffee, seems like too much effort now. She eases onto the frontage road, merges onto the on-ramp, the purple bracelet of bruising that encircles her right wrist almost pulsing at her eyes as she makes her way onto the freeway. He'd been like the killer the way he was. Bad Billy. Drunk Billy. Bad luck Billy, whose sure thing at the racetrack turned into a terrible debt he'd never been able to pay. Mad, mean Billy, who passed the mad down to her with his fists and his boots and a belt buckle that sliced her scalp open. Dead Billy, whose yawning red neck was what he got for his trouble while he worried over the receipts in the garage. And though up until now she had every intention to head straight back to their trailer to haul poor old Billy inside and torch the whole shit heap, it really seems like too much effort now. Instead, she cruises north to nowhere in particular, far away from their trailer where she'd sipped her last cup of instant as the sun came up over the junipers that border the park and decided today was the day she was finally going to kill that rotten son of a bitch. It's only just south of Waco that she remembers Billy's mama lives outside Fort Worth, a little block of one-bedroom apartments built mostly from cinder blocks, and Fort Worth isn't so far from Waco. She smiles softly, fires up another cigarette, and decides it's all right with her if the old bag gets to see her boy one last time. It's only right. She touches the sticky gash at her hairline, crusted over with her own dry brown blood, and her smile melts away. The cut, still fresh, stings to the touch. She drags deep from her smoke and wonders what will come next after Billy's mama sees what she has done. Those cinder block apartments just won't burn the same as that old trailer would have. That, she knows, would have been such a sight. A pothole escapes her attention and she crunches the undercarriage right over it. The gas cans in the trunk rattle around, knocking all over poor dead Billy. Come on, baby, she says in a sweet sing-song sort of way. Let's go see Mama.
Jesus.
Oh, my God. I swear to God, first of all, your voice just took over Sam Elliott's in my brain as the sexiest voice in the world. And what a fucking story. Oh, my God. That was excellent.
Thank you.
Sorry, I had to cut in and say something. That was incredible. And maybe it's the way you read it, but that was incredible. I'm having a hot flash here, Eric. I'm turning
it
back over.
She's got the vapors.
I do.
I'm a heterosexual male, but I want to share a jail cell with that voice. Let me tell you,
damn.
That's some heavy business.
I'll turn you out, Eric.
Oh my God.
Great job, Ed. Great job. The voice and the story, you know, but like, and the story. But that's great job. Hey, what do you got coming down the pipe? I look on your Amazon page, and there's some stuff still to come. So you want to talk about any of it?
Well, the last thing I had come out in January is a crime novel called Nausea, a little bit of existential nihilism and murder that some folks might enjoy, but. Next one down the pipe is in September from Cheesing. It's called The Rib From Which I Remake the World. And
Excellent title.
It's a weird little bit of black magic and Deep South World War II era Southern noir.
That's one thing that I picked up your 42 over the holidays and read it. And that's one thing. And then, not to mention your Thuglit, your Christmas Thuglit contribution, which is great. That's one thing that I think you've just really got a knack for, man, is getting into the history and the area of a place that's long gone and then just blowing it out. You know what I mean? Like, a lot of times with authors, that's really painstaking and it takes out of the story, like all of this exposition, but you just managed to really kind of blend it together and put you right into the place. So big kudos on that, dude. And I'm looking forward to the real world. And then hopefully, how much does it cost to get you to come out and read the stories to people if they get your book?
Well, there'll be airfare, lodging, and I guess enough coffee and cigarettes to get me through.
Well, it's a steal, let me tell you. It's a steal. Thank you very much for coming. Hey, do you miss the South? Is there anything going on? Do you miss it? Are you just stoked in Minnesota? You're like, this is home.
I like it up here. I do, but I do miss the South. I've lived in the South almost my whole life, so it's definitely still a bit of culture shock up here.
Yeah, I've watched Fargo. I kind of got the idea there.
I've met a lot of
anytime
people like that.
Anytime you find yourself down this way, man, give us a holler, and we'll set something up. All right, thank you very much, Ed. Now let's get over to our last reader of the evening, definitely not least. We're very excited to have Jordan Harper here. Jordan was born and raised in the Missouri. Hello?
Nah, go for it, man.
Oh, sorry. Jordan Harper was born and raised in the Missouri Ozarks. His short story collection, Love and Other Wounds, was published last year. His first novel, If All Roads Were Blind, will be published this winter. He now lives in Los Angeles. I'll just kind of throw a little extra there. I read Love and Other Wounds. It blew my hair back. Like, I was saving stories so that I wouldn't just read them all at once. It was a great job. You've also contributed to the holiday edition of Thuglit, which I thought was a genius publication, by the way, for Todd to put that out for the holidays. It decked my halls. But it should also be mentioned that you wrote tonight's episode of Gotham, but you've written a couple. You're the supervising producer, and all the people that have just been crying that the show went as dark as it did. Thank God. That's your fault. So you can
thank
you yourself.
Much.
Very glad to have you on here, Jordan. I met you in New York City. I'm glad to hear you read tonight. What do you got?
Well, I got. In fact, it might be something you heard me read in New York City because it's the most southern piece of flash fiction I have. It's something from my self-published short story collection, American Death Songs. It's called Midnight Rider, and it does get better the more you know about the Allman Brothers.
Yes.
All right.
Well, take it away, brother.
All right. I do not believe in the devil or the sanctity of Jesus Christ, but I'm telling you that something greater than you or me put that song on the radio at just that moment. Just that moment when the cop hit his cherries and filled the night with swirling blue and red. The timing was just too right to be anything but a message meant for me. I got the message. I understood what it was asking, and I said, hell yes. Flashback a couple minutes, back when the cop first pulled out behind us on Route 23. Now, when you're cruising in a stolen car with 20 pounds of mule-strong Nazi dope in the trunk, and the air is rock concert hazy from the roach burning in the ashtray, when you take the farm roads to avoid humanity and wind up with a cop car riding up your ass, you get the fear. That deep brain fear, that kind that came from tiny mammals who learned to freeze when the snake slid by. The fear gets you where you can't reach forward to stamp out the roach or turn down the radio. It's a weird trip the fear has taken from the glands of our mammal mothers down to a couple of sorry stone bastards who are doing no good and doing it dumb. And it's weird things your stone brain will think about when you got the fear. What do we do? Pinkle asked. Now, my man Pinkle is the type of friend you have that in a moment of clarity is all the sign you need that your life has gone shit side up. He was meth skinny with a disposition as rotten as his picket fence teeth. He'd take your last cigarette and he'd keep your lighter too if you didn't ask for it back. And he'd pick you up for a dope deal in a stolen car. And then he'd have the shiny steel balls to talk you into getting behind the wheel. And then, as the cop car loomed behind us on the road, I saw that Pinkle had his hand on the car door handle. This suck-mouth son of a bitch was planning on jumping ship. Sure as shit, the cop would chase me if Pinkle bailed, and I'd be the one caught with 20 pounds of dope and my dick in my hand. Before I could tell him where to stick it, the cop lights filled the car, blue and red, and just right at that moment, I mean exactly that moment, the first notes of Midnight Rider by the Allman Brothers Band came in with its sweet, strong sound. What else could I do? I stomped on the gas and away we went. Hear that guitar, man. Dwayne Allman, a couple of years before his motorcycle smeared him like a modern art masterpiece down 50 feet of Georgia asphalt. Da-da-dun-dun-da-dun. Mournful, but steady, like a sheriff walking out into the street to meet his sure end at the hands of John Wesley Harden. It's the sound of a man running the race best he can, knowing death is at the finish line, and the thing of it is, brother, that's the truth for every one of us. The cop came after me, of course, but he was in a cop car, and I was in a goddamn sure-footed chariot of glory being yanked down the road by a double dose of Greg fucking Allman. Double dose, man, because Greg's harmonizing with himself in that song, and when the cop triggered his sirens, somehow they harmonized with Greg too, and I knew for a fact that the message had been received. Pinkle had bug eyes, and he begged me to stop, but I couldn't hear him. I was too busy wondering if this cop knew about the Sunset Pass. The Sunset Pass was this little side street that was coming up on the right in about 2 miles. And the turn was sudden, but gentle, so if you knew it was there, you could make it well over 80 miles an hour, which is about where I had her right then. But if you weren't ready for it, you'd fly right past. Oh, shit, bets, man. His solo kicked in, and you knew the end was coming. Tall grass and sleeping cattle whipped past us on either side. I could feel every bump in the road. They were all in time with the song, and we were all a part of the song, and I was singing, and I was laughing, and it was right, and it was good. Dwayne hit that riff, and Greg sang his part again. He was running, and so was I. Here came the Sunset Pass. I shut off the lights. We rolled in the dark, the music all around us. We left the ground as we hit the dip down to the pass. I was right about one thing. The cop whipped right past us down Route 23. We would have gotten away clean if that flatbed truck hadn't been coming the other way. We hit it midair, and Pinkle went through the windshield, twisting and clawing and screaming through the night like Superman with a load on. See, he undid his seatbelt when he was thinking on bailing on me, the little shit. So I sat there alone, thinking it was a flatbed truck that ruined Dwayne's day, too. And also, there was an awful lot of blood and glass everywhere, and Dickie's guitar lead faded into nothing, and there was silence. And the silence at the end was right, too. Then a new song kicked in. The Carpenters, man. I hate the Carpenters. And I couldn't even reach up to change it. You tell me. What's the message in that? Thank you.
Jordan Harper, ladies and gentlemen. Excellent. Yes.
Hey, thank
you very much. Hey, let me ask you, like, I read Love and Other Wounds. Absolutely loved it. Like I said, I was saving stories because I didn't want to. Each story was better than the last. I feel like I know the answer. Like, I can still see good Southern sensibilities between the dog fighting and, you know, the brutal, you know, the quest for survival, and it's the forever descriptions of teeth. You did it in this one too. You're always describing somebody's crosshatch teeth. So, I mean, I could see the Southern sensibilities in each of the stories, but, like, do you feel like you tap into that? Even, like, with your work on Gotham, or just, do you take the South with you, or have you moved on?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. You know, I think I don't particularly write about the Ozarks too much anymore, because I haven't lived in the Ozarks for over a decade now. But I cannot stop writing about white trash, you know, and I do feel like, you know, that's where I come from. And that's what I understand, just like the basic code of white trash people and, you know, the basic language and the syntax of it. So I still always write about that. I tend now to write about the people of Southern California who are like that, the folks of the Inland Empire, like people out in Fontana, California, which is known as Fontucky around here for all the rednecks that I have. So, yeah, you know, I think I carry the sensibility with me for sure. Now, I don't think much of that ever makes on VR and say a show like Gotham. Well, I will say this is the first time I've said this publicly, so this is news for anybody who happens to be following my life, but I actually am not with Gotham anymore. I am now a freelance, full-time writer on my own. So I'm off into the wild blue yonder as far as that's concerned. But
dude, that's got to be exciting because, wherever you go, dude, I'm sure you're going to bring some nasty business with you.
Oh, thank you.
The new novel you have coming out, If All Roads Were Blunt. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to remind everyone, if you want to call in and speak to any of the authors, the number is 347-633-9609. The phone lines are open, so give us a call. Go ahead, Eric.
Yes, please. I'd love to talk to any of y'all, so get on the phone and holler at us. And, a question for any one of these people out here. Just real quick, one last question for Jordan. Your new novel's coming out, If All Roads Were Blind. When's that coming out? What's it about?
Well, it's coming out sometime this winter. The exact date hasn't been set yet. And it's basically, it's Paper Moon with a body count. It's about an 11-year-old girl who is kidnapped by her father because they've been marked for death by the Aryan Brotherhood. And so her estranged father kidnaps her. Her mother's already been murdered, unbeknownst to her. And it's a road trip throughout Southern California as this criminal father and his daughter learn to love each other and she learns how to be a criminal. And it involves her, you know, changing from this very shy little girl to a girl who helps rob a meth lab, you know, run by the Aryan Brotherhood at one point, and she gets into a fight with a pit bull hand to hand at some point. It's a pretty exciting little novel. I'm excited for it to come out.
I'm looking forward to it. I'll throw a question out to everybody, you know, everybody on the panel, all six writers, until Pam let us know when we get a phone call. I'll just ask questions until then. Hey, any of y'all find yourself writing with an accent, you know, like with a Southern accent? Like, I'm not talking about just doing like dialect, you know, when your character's like, hey, can I help you? But like, you know, your narration, do you find yourself writing with your Southern accent?
Not intentionally when I'm writing. I think it's just the natural voice.
Well, to be honest, I don't actually have a Southern accent anymore, although I think it's crept back in when y'all talk. But
Jordan?
Yeah, my work here is done.
Right?
People say I sound like I'm from New York.
Jordan, you definitely have your Southern accent, dear. I'm sorry. it's loud and proud.
Thank you.
I never knew
I'm useless without the word reckon.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I never knew I had an accent. I lived in Philadelphia for a while. And then it was like people would come up to me and have me say words and would get a kick out of me saying different words. Like, go ahead, say tomorrow. And of course, I dropped the T-O off. So I'm like, Mara. And it just peeled with laughter. So I didn't realize I had an accent until I lived in North Philly for a few months.
That cured you of it, though?
I did theater when I was
Did that cure you of your accent? Did that cure you of your accent?
To an extent, I kind of stopped talking and just nodded. But then, people thought I was a mute.
Eric, you've still got your accent.
Oh, I mean, most of it's embellished. Most of it's just I've made half of it up. I was in theater when I was younger, and they kept me after for 2 hours to get me to say the word pen right. They were like, dude, you can do it, dude. Pen. I was like, pen. So, I struggled with it for a long time, but, after a while, I was like, you know what, this is how I talk. You know, everybody can come around to me. You know, this is how I talk. I'm useless without the word reckon or yahoo. You know, not yahoo, yahoo. Yeah, check out that yahoo idiot over there. No, I'm useless without it. So it's not yahoo, it's yahoo.
I get teased because apparently up north you get maybe north of D.C. and nobody says cuss, they say curse. And so they always peg me on cuss, because apparently you curse up north and you cuss down south.
Dude.
No shit, really?
I'm about to. I'm fixing the cuss and cursing, motherfucker.
I've drank with Mr. Fruit before, and the more we drink, the more southern we get.
Well, I definitely have to come to Durham then to try that out.
Dude, trust me. Durham will be a fun one, especially after this conversation here. I mean, I'd be pleased as punch if all seven of us read. So you guys make your plane trip accordingly. Do we have anybody calling in, Pam? Anybody trying to get in on us?
It's quiet, but we have a lot of listeners. I always know when it's a great show when no one calls because they want to listen to what the authors have to say. So good on you. The next time Noir on the Radio is on will be on the 28th when Danny Gardner hosts Noir on the Radio, Dames in the Dark. That will be interesting. Can't wait. In the meantime, our next Noir on the Radio will be next month. In April is going to be on the 12th with Michael Poole. And then Marietta Miles is doing our Dames in the Dark in April. So that should be a lot of fun, too. Eric, you and your guests have been so spectacular tonight. I cannot thank you enough for being here on Noir on the Radio.
Thank you.
Gosh, everybody's stories were just tremendous. You were just really great. Feel free to go ahead and post the podcast links up on your social media. And thanks for being with us tonight, everybody, especially Eric Foot, my Southern Slam host. You'll be back when? I don't know. When are you coming back, Eric?
I don't think – I know you and I have an interview on June the 8th. You and I have an interview on June the 8th. And then I think we're gonna work out the rest. So we'll figure it out. But we'll have something
right.
Set up. Really, it's a lot of fun.
And as I said, Greg Barth is gonna do a show in June, right, Greg? You're doing a show with Games
June
in the Dark
21st,
on the 21st, right? Sean Cosby, I'd love for you to go ahead and host one day. Would you like to put together a group?
Yeah, we could talk about that. That'd be great. I really appreciate it. Definitely will be something I'm interested in.
All right.
Yeah,
thank
Sean,
you so much, everybody.
Sean, by the way,
yeah,
Sean's like
what
Wikipedia
clerk.
When it comes to crime fiction, dude, so be careful. He knows more than everybody.
A wealth of useless knowledge.
I am but the student here, which is why I don't host the show. I host Authors on the Air, so... This one is a little bit, this is over my pay grade. That's why I get you guys, the experts, to come in and do it. So I want to thank our host tonight, Eric Pruitt. Again, go
thank
and
you.
Check Eric out on his, he's everywhere, but go and listen to his show too, Crime Scene with Eric Pruitt. And then pay attention to the Noir at the Bar series. He's putting one together in Durham, but also don't forget there's an Atlanta show coming up and that's going to be great too. Thanks for being with us, authors. You all are great. You really were.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
Thank you so much.
You're absolutely
thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah,
thanks,
thank
everybody.
You.
Have a really great night. See ya.
All right. Thank you. Appreciate it. Good night.
Bye-bye. Good night.
Thank you all.
Good night. Good night.